Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. This is our weekly show where we give you all of the LSAT Demon Daily episodes throughout the week. I'm Nathan Fox, that's Ben Olson. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week.
This is an email from Jay.
Yep, just says, hello, is there any update on Rachel's free demon class? Thank you, Jay. We talked about this on Thinking LSAT just very recently, and there is an update. The class is called How to Get a Law Job You Love. It's going to be Saturday, May 14th, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. I think it's going to be super useful. All you need is a free demon account. Go to lsat.link/Rachel, and you can sign up for a free class about networking your way into not just a job, but a job you're actually going to love. Rachel on Thinking LSAT spoke very passionately about how much she likes her job. And it was like, because of the networking that she did, they ended up creating a perfect job for her.
Yeah.
You know, you contrast that with the typical resume drop bullshit that is like completely soul sucking and just devastating to send out 100 resumes to jobs that were not designed for you and they don't know you and they're getting thousands of applications and it's just this nightmare. And Rachel has a better way of getting jobs. I think that you can apply this to things outside of the legal job market, by the way.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be useful for everybody. Read this. So I'm talking to somebody who is a current user of Rachel's book.
Okay.
One of our students said this in the italics. Why don't you read that?
Yeah. It says, I started the worksheets last night. Rachel has worksheets in her book. It's a very hands-on, do this sort of stuff book, not just, hey, let me tell you the theory about getting a job. It's like, I'm going to have you start getting a job. Anyways, this person says she started the worksheets. She has you write down what your mental blocks are preventing you from achieving what you want and how you would fix them if you had unlimited abilities and resources. I found that helpful. Made me nail down what things I'm being pussy about and got me thinking about how I actually could resolve those things. Okay.
Yeah. Kind of starkly put, but
yep. Everybody's got their own word choices.
But I liked it. I was like, oh, cool. Yeah. Like, you know, it just, I don't know. I'm not some like paragon of wisdom or whatever, but I do think that one of the hardest things in life is just deciding what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that these worksheets are oriented in that direction. It's like, hey, let's think about what you really would like if you had unlimited abilities, unlimited resources. Like, what is it that you really want? Okay, what's stopping you from getting those things that you really want? And then let's set to work on, you know, overcoming those obstacles. And that's not to say that all of them are going to be possible, but probably some of them are. And I don't know, I think it can feel really good to people to start working on the things that they can actually do something about.
Yeah. Well, I think this is not to pile on here, but I do really like this advice actually, because what astounds me, right? Like, I have more than my share of kids, and when we're talking about things that they want to do and why they're not doing them or whatever, what blows me away often is the roadblocks in their minds are not roadblocks, right? It's like, wait, you can't do that because what? You're like, oh, it's going to cost too much or something like that. Or whatever their roadblock is. And oftentimes it's like, oh no, all we have to do is just call this person and ask them to do this. And now problem solved. But in their mind, it's a deal breaker. It's over. They're not even considering doing this other thing that they're considering because there's this thing that's in the way. And I think this is a universal problem. When you're not in a domain that you're comfortable with or familiar with, it's, you have so many reasons why you can't do it. And the reality is a lot of those are completely unreal or based on just misinformation or bad assumptions. And it's like, okay, let's assume you had unlimited abilities and resources. Figure out what you would actually do, and then ask ourselves what roadblocks are in the way, and are they actually roadblocks? Do they even exist, for one?
Right. Well, we were talking about this on our teacher Slack yesterday. One of our teachers said, well, there's this novel issue that came up in class. One of my students said that they couldn't, they were worried about their LSAT upcoming because they had just broken a finger on their writing hand.
Yep.
And the teacher didn't know what advice to give. And, you know, we are happy to offer helpful advice. Ben, you actually went and started writing with different grips, and you found that you were able to write without one or more of your
fingers. Actually surprised. I was like, wow, I really don't need my index finger. I am just as legible with my middle finger. But I don't know.
My reaction was a little bit stronger. My reaction was, what are you talking about? That's not even an obstacle. This is not a written essay exam. This is, you're supposed to be making a little sketch of the clowns getting out of the clown car or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not an art project. You don't get points for how much you write. You get points for figuring out the system, and the work is going on in your brain. Yes, you are going to put some stuff on the page, but I'm pretty sure you could just go ahead and write with your other hand, or you could, I don't know, like the amount that you actually have to write is just not that much anyway. So I guess the point, and I mean, I feel for somebody who has a broken hand, that sucks, broken finger. I just feel like that's an obstacle that is not really an obstacle. You could make it into an obstacle. I mean, you could just go ahead and cancel your LSAT administration and, you know, but I don't know. To me, that sounds more like maybe there are other reasons why you're not really ready for the test. If you're really ready for the test, I'm pretty sure you could break my hand and I could still go ahead and score perfectly on the LSAT logic games. I could definitely do it left-handed. I just don't think it would matter. So these obstacles are not always the super deal breaking obstacles that you think they are.
Yeah. Again, the link for Rachel's class is lsat.link/Rachel. Just go there and you can sign up. All you need is a demon free account.
We have an email here from G.
Hi friends. ! I've got what's hopefully a fun, or at least not repetitive, one for you.
We have an email here from G.
If you're up for it. In those moments where we struggle to come up with a prediction, especially for logical reasoning, are there questions that you suggest we ask ourselves to at least get us moving on something? The origin of this question is some of my class sessions lately, where sometimes I'll just read a question completely blank, reread it once or twice, and then have this moment where I go, okay, but so I don't really have anything to say about this. What the hell do I do now? Does not having a reaction to the passage mean that I don't actually understand it?
Yeah, mostly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the passages on the LSAT are weird, wonky, right? There's just something stupid about them. And even when they're not stupid, that's when I'm surprised. I'm like, wait, I think that argument actually makes sense. And that itself is a reaction, right?
Right.
Anyways, G continues, I literally always, that's underlined, screw up when I get lazy and go back to the old test-taking method of just looking for the answer. I know, bad. So I really need to not do that. But when I have no prediction or reaction, at least not at first, what do I do to go back to backtrack and come up with something? Any guidance on how to get out of those frozen moments would be awesome. Thanks so much. Well, yeah, first, I mean, I think you're diagnosing your own problem. First and foremost, understand each sentence. I mean, when G said, what, I reread it once or twice? That sounds like rereading the whole passage. Like, you need to be catching your lack of reaction mid first sentence, end of first sentence at the latest. There's some reaction like, okay, that sounds like that sentence comports with my understanding of the world, or no, that's weird. Why is this person saying that? It's going to be at least one of those two reactions.
Yeah, you got to chew your fucking food, man. Students just keep shoveling more in without chewing it. And then they just essentially, gee, what's happening when you don't have any reaction at all, you just like you stuffed your mouth full of food. You haven't chewed it. Like you're going to like choke on it is basically what's going to happen. I rarely reread arguments.
No. Yeah. But I reread sentences all the time.
Exactly. I will reread sentences, especially the first sentence, especially the first half of the first sentence.
Yeah.
Because and that's the equivalent of taking a reasonable bite and chewing it thoroughly before you take another bite.
You're like an animal that has been placed in it, dropped into a new environment, right? Like you got to like look around and be like, okay, where the hell am I? What is going on here? Maybe that's not the best analogy because I imagine most animals in that situation are terrified, but and you don't need to be terrified, but you need to like figure out what's going on. And that's why we spend so much time on that first sentence. Sometimes it's just orienting yourself. Like what are we talking about now? Yeah.
Gee, you know, there's two things going on. We don't read the question first. So we're just assessing, we're going to attack the passage every time. I'm expecting there to be an argument. I'm expecting the argument to be bullshit. So I'm expecting it kind of to not make sense. Like I'm expecting them to say something stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to read everything very carefully and I'm going to give them credit for their facts. They are going to present evidence. Even when they do make a bad argument, they're going to present evidence and then they're going to make a dumb conclusion based on that evidence.
Yeah,
that's the most common pattern that we see on the LSAT. That's what I'm looking for here is like, well, what's your evidence? What dumbass conclusion are you going to try to make from that? And I start that process immediately. First sentence, first half of the first sentence. Okay, what is this? Are you starting with your conclusion? Are you starting with a premise? What's going on? What are you doing to me here? What's your point? And I'm going to understand it independent of itself. Then when I start reading additional premises, and by the way, sometimes that can be two premises in the first sentence, or it can be a premise and a conclusion in the first sentence. There's lots of stuff they can do in just one sentence, but I'm going to be looking at the pieces and parts. I'm going to be understanding each one of those pieces and parts, and I'm going to be looking to synthesize. But many times it's going to be like, wait, what now? You have this evidence and this conclusion? Huh? You're trying to conclude this from this evidence?
Yeah.
And at that point, I know it sounds like I'm confused, but I'm confused in the television detective way, like Columbo, you know, the bumbling cop who's just coming in, scratching his head like, what? There's just what I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. I need to ask this one question. And of course, it's like that question is like the solution to the mystery, right?
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing. And man, if you're not confused, then you're just not like having no reaction whatsoever. That means you just don't even know what's there. Yeah. Now, some percentage of the time, you know, I'm going to get done with it and I'm going to go, well, I didn't see any conclusion in this.
Sure. Sometimes this seems just like a bunch of facts.
Every brick house has a front yard. Every front yard has two stories. Oh, wait, that question actually does have an argument in it, I think. Yeah, it does. It concludes so most of the whatever. Anyway, point is, they could just give fun facts about whatever.
Sure.
At which point I go, but even then, I'm going to be looking to combine things together.
Yeah, like what can I deduce from this? What must be true given the facts that you've given me? Yeah.
If you told me, you know, like all Northerners hate the Lannisters and Jon Snow is a Northerner, you know, then I'm immediately going to go, oh, well, Jon Snow, a Northerner, all Northerners hate Lannisters. So Jon Snow must hate Lannisters.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be doing that like as I read.
It's active reading. It's like putting together what the person is saying on your own so that if the person then goes ahead and draws a conclusion or not, but if they do, you already know whether it's good or bad because you've come to your own conclusion.
Right. Yeah. G, I think the best thing for G is you got to stop reading the whole passage and you got to instead start reading one sentence at a time. What did you say, Ben? Your job is not to comprehend the passage.
That's right. It's to comprehend the first sentence.
It's to comprehend the first sentence.
Yep.
And you could break that down even further. If the first sentence is intimidating, your job is not to comprehend the first sentence. Your job is to comprehend the first part of the first sentence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you've got to, I think this is actually probably a pretty common thing. Gee, thank you for writing in daily at lsatdemon.com, by the way. If you want to submit anything for the show, please do that. We don't get enough emails. Daily at lsatdemon.com. G's question has got to be super, super common among our students, mm-hmm. among all students.
Sure.
Well, let me just read
the I've experienced it in class. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
They just do that. They go, oh, let me just read the whole passage. I'm just going to read the whole thing. And they get to the end and absolutely nothing has gone in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what did they say there? And they go, and then they go back and they start rereading from the beginning.
Yep.
And it's like, well, okay, nothing at all went in. You have to start making sense of this test. The test makes sense, but it's your job to make sense of it. And so you have to fucking get in there. Like, you got to dig in.
Yeah. I was going to say the next level of that. So you're referring to the folks, and there's a lot of them, who aren't paying attention, right? And then it's like a different level of not paying attention. You have the folks that are paying attention. They know what was said, but for whatever reason, they seem to be asleep. It's like, hey, the passage just told you that this forest is about to be irreversibly damaged. And that's because they're planting trees in that forest.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm like,
yeah.
What do you think of that? Does that make sense to you? I mean, to me, that sounds like a...
Right.
It doesn't make sense. If you're planting trees, the forest would probably benefit. So now I'm expecting some sort of paradox or some sort of, you know, question that tries to explain why that's happening. And everybody seems to be like snoozing. No reaction.
100%.
Anyway.
Yeah. You've got to wake up, mm-hmm. and you've got to give them credit for their evidence, but not give them credit for their conclusions. You've got to be ready to pounce on that conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Even sometimes it's the first sentence, you know, your argument that you just made, they could have started with, the forest is about to be irreversibly damaged.
Yeah.
And you could be like, oh, well, I'm not sure if that's evidence or conclusion, but you should be willing, if that turns out to be the conclusion of the argument, you're going to be calling bullshit, right? You're going to look for an opportunity to say, well, it doesn't have to be irrevocably damaged.
Like it's never coming back. Like, that's quite the claim.
How could you possibly make that prediction about literally infinitely into the future?
Yep.
Right. Anyway, yeah. Maybe enough for G.
Yep.
We could go on all day with that one. That was a good one, G.
This email is from Annie, smiley face.
Hey, Ben and Nathan, I took your advice to wait a year and apply for next cycle so that I can give myself the best chance for admissions and scholarships. Love that.
Okay.
No wonder she's smiling. That's a good decision.
Yep.
With the 2023 application cycle approaching quickly, I was wondering if you had a checklist of items you recommend that we should have ready to go before applications open. For example, the best LSAT score we can get, transcripts, resume, personal statement, etc. Anything you guys could think of in addition to these things would be helpful for first-time applicants. Exclamation point. Thank you, Annie, smiley face.
Okay. The only concern I have about talking about this list is I fear that the items 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 can become excuses to not focus on item number one.
Well, although LSAT's not even number one, right?
GPA. So yeah. Items 1 and 2.
Yep. So, right. We should do this, actually, or maybe our team, if you're listening. Make us a little graphic where 1 and 2 are like gigantic. You can make a checklist.
You can't even like read.
3, 4, 5, 6. They're like down on the page. They're like microscopic font. But 1 and 2, gigantic. The best grades you can get. And that means don't even worry about the LSAT. if you're still an undergrad, you need to be getting straight A's in every class. Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. number one on the list.
Yeah.
And what's number two?
Number two is your best LSAT score. And really, the rest of your list needs to be blurry and not legible, right? I don't want you looking at the best LSAT score and then kind of like, oh, well, this is a little difficult, so I'm going to mosey on down here and work on something else, right?
We but all these do this law with- schools tell me that they look at applications holistically, and they're telling me about my personal statement and my letters of recommendation, and I need to work on those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they absolutely do not have your best interests in mind.
Yeah, they're just trying to get you to tick off all the boxes. For them, the boxes have equal weight because you have to do all of the boxes. They can't admit you if you don't do all the boxes. All they want, they're not trying to make you a better applicant. They're trying to make you apply. They want your application now. That's all they want. They don't want you to be a more savvy applicant. They want you to be a less savvy applicant. They just want you to be an applicant today. That's what they want.
Yeah.
So they're going to give you bad advice about all this other shit. But here's the fact, Ben. This is the most compelling fact, I think, that we have to offer. Mm. We can predict how much scholarship money you're likely to get based on your LSAT and your GPA and a checkbox for URM status.
Yep.
Now, we can't predict it with perfect accuracy, but we can predict it with increasingly good accuracy.
Yep.
Based on those three tiny little bits of data. Yep. Like, so, and then people always ask me, they're like, but my master's, but I got it, but I was, I wrote a paper with this. I've got a letter of recommendation from a set, blah, blah.
I have really good softs.
Yeah. Just all those things that are yeah. all fall under the larger umbrella of soft, but my yeah. work experience, blah. And it's like, okay, let me repeat myself. I can predict your scholarships to law school, not just whether you're going to get in. Mm-hmm. I can predict how much money they're going to offer you.
Yep.
Based on your LSAT, your GPA, and whether you're URM or not. Yep. URM is a small factor, but LSAT and GPA. Yep. I can predict whether they're going to offer you money based on your LSAT and your GPA. But my soft, it's like, everybody wants to go back to these issues. And it's like, okay, but I don't know. They're just, why are people so resistant to facts?
Yeah.
Now, again, it ain't perfect, but it's a damn good tool. Go to lsatdemon.com/scholarships if you want to see the tool that I'm talking about.
Yeah. And it's, and once you have those two things, I want you to get these other ducks in a row. I want you to get your transcripts. I want you to get your resume. I want you to work on your personal statement more than 2 days. I want you to get your letters of recommendation. You need to get these things to apply. I want you to decide on which schools you are going to apply to. The problem about talking about these things is not that they're not good. It's that I don't want them to compete with what is absolutely essential and the most important.
Yeah. The only two that are going to take, well, there's, I guess there's three that might take significant time, but there's two of these elements that are out of your control.
Yep.
Getting the transcripts submitted through from your undergraduate schools, schools plural, if there were more than one.
Yep.
That you need to get, that's going to be out of your control. So you need to submit those requests and make sure that those transcripts are getting uploaded to LSAC.
Yeah.
The other one, even more time consuming, is letters of recommendation. Those requests can just sit in your recommender's inbox for months and they could do nothing with them. So you should send off those requests for LORs sooner rather than later. And then you might have to do some ass kissing and some follow up and, you know, maybe submit, maybe ask four people, even though you only need two letters, just to make sure that that process is moving along.
Mm-hmm.
But those are things to do when you're either already done with your undergrad and done with your LSAT, or late at night, you're too tired to do the LSAT, your eyes are burning, but you want to do something productive.
Yeah.
And you know you can't give it your best on your schoolwork or on your LSAT. Okay, submit those letters of recommendation requests. Submit those transcript requests.
Sure.
The only other one that really should take any time, because it's not like addenda and all these other essays and stuff. I mean, that's just like so far down the power ranking of things that actually matter to law school admissions. Your personal statement is the thing that, you know, if they really are on the bubble about you, which you're not going to be on the bubble if you don't have the right LSAT and GPA, or if you have a good enough LSAT and GPA, you're also not on the bubble.
You're well above it. Yeah.
Because you're just, they're thinking about how much scholarship money they're going to offer you. But the personal statement is how they differentiate, you know, like from like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, Ben says he wants you to work on it for more than 2 days. Maybe, but I think you could draft it in an hour. I think you could put it away, look at it again 2 days from now, clean up the editing, ask a friend, clean up the editing again, keep cutting, write it longer and cut and cut and cut and cut, cut it down. But this is not an arduous writing assignment. Ultimately it's a page and a half about the thing you know more about than anyone on the planet, which is you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just not that hard to write your personal statement. Write a shitty first draft, maybe write a couple different shitty first drafts, put it away, come back and edit it. Just make sure it's clean. It isn't the type of thing that you should waste significant chunks of your life on, as evidenced from the fact that law schools and even law school admissions consultants just, they seem to advocate writing a bunch of bullshit in your personal statement.
Mm-hmm.
Ben doesn't have anything to offer. He's just waiting for me to shut up.
I mean, yeah, it's just, I do think people struggle with their writing. Spend more time on it. But this is all assuming that these other things are in place. I keep thinking about like trying to put together a team, right? Like you're trying to put together a basketball team or a football team, and some kid comes to you and they clearly have game, right? Like they can play,
yep.
But they didn't submit their application correctly. You're like, you know what? That's okay. We're gonna get other people to get that all sorted out so you can play on my team, right? But if you don't have game, then it's like, I don't care that you showed up on time to the first practice and you're smiling and you've got your all your forms submitted. It's like, yeah, but you can't play. So your LSAT score is your indication that you can play this game called law school and lawyering.
Yeah.
And your GPA, your UGPA, your undergraduate GPA. Those two things together show that you have game, and everything else can be cobbled together. But those can't be cobbled together.
No. We need to do this. Team, if you're listening to me, your boss is asking you to do this. Make a law school application checklist where there's two giant boxes at the top and then like super tiny font with all the other things that you need to do. Because it really is. I mean, law schools they're not going to be honest about this. They hate the idea that you're just a number to them. You know, they're going to give you all manner of bullshit about how they look at applications holistically and on and on and on. But the scoreboard says otherwise. The American Bar Association 509 data says otherwise. Every law school has very narrow ranges of LSAT and GPA. And yeah, sure, there's exceptions, but you don't want to be a barely squeak in exception who has to pay full price. You want to be the one who's there on a scholarship. And that's going to be your LSAT and your GPA that are going to get you that scholarship. So thank you, Annie, for writing in. All those other things are necessary, but they're just not, whatever. Those are just like ticking off a bunch of boxes. Gabe says, hi, Ben and Nathan. I've been studying using the Demon for a month now, and I'm a huge fan of the program and the two podcasts. I've gone from a 157 diagnostic to a 167 on my latest practice test in that time. Since I've been focusing so hard on practice tests and drilling test material, the required LSAT writing sample has been somewhat of an afterthought. I haven't heard you guys touch on it much, and I'd like your expertise on the weight of this writing sample on applications and your direction on how best to prepare for it. I think we can do that in 5 minutes or less. go for it.
Yeah. It's not graded. It's not important. Obviously, when you do it, you should do the best job you can on it, but that's about it. And in terms of preparation, we have an example or two in LSAT Demon. So,
yeah, we have, you can probably also find them on YouTube. I mean, we have some just like very short little lessons on how to do it. Mm-hmm. I do think it's worth 15 minutes of preparation, but not more than 15 minutes of preparation. I don't think you should ever practice it at all. Like Ben says, it's not scored. It's not part of your 120 to 180. They don't report the results on their 509 report. We've never heard, you know, a law school dean talk about the importance of it or whatever.
Never.
Many schools have explicitly said in the past that they just ignore them entirely. Mm-hmm. But it will accompany all of your law school applications. And these days, now that it's typed and word processed, it would make more sense that schools start to kind of pay attention, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you would. I would. If mm-hmm. I was a law school, I would look at yeah. it. It yeah. tells me a hell of a lot more, honestly, than your personal statement.
Yeah, it's writing that you had to write by yourself.
With a proctor.
Mm-hmm.
In time.
Yep.
You know, it's like... And like someone like Ben, someone like me, we can make judgments about your writing ability in one sentence or two sentences. And so, it, you know, like the same thing with the personal statement, really, right, Ben? Like you'd look at it and then two sentences, you'd have some ideas.
Yeah.
Yep. But we could do that with the LSAT writing sample just as easily. So follow the directions. Definitely follow the assignment. You're supposed to be advocating for one side over the other, and that means something very explicitly. They're giving you like a plan A, plan B, but they're basically equivalent, and they yeah. want you not to do a book report on the two plans, but they want you to pick a plan and choose a plan and advocate for that plan, like emphasize the strengths of that plan and the weaknesses of the other.
Yes, and... That does not mean to ignore inconvenient facts, right? Like sometimes people advocate for a position by saying why they think you should do X, and then they just conveniently ignore anything that would go against that position. You need to address the weak facts of your case.
You could do that, right? But you also could instead acknowledge and then spin it. And so like mm-hmm. if you can find a way to say, well, it's true that plan A has this, but... Plan B has this better version of that.
Yeah.
You know, or it's true that plan A has this weakness, but plan B has an even worse weakness over here.
Yep.
And that's advocacy. So, you know, you don't get to make facts up, but you want to spin those facts in your favor. I don't think we need to say anything more about the LSAT writing sample.
No. I do need to say something more about your background. It is already lighting up. So I was curious... Like, how fast is the Earth moving? Do you have any guess?
around the sun or no, how fast is it spinning?
Is it spinning, right? Because
yeah. around its axis. Oh, Jesus. This is like a Google interview question. You know, what is the Earth? Let's see. So the diameter of the Earth mm-hmm. is going to be shit. Just totally wildly guessing. The diameter of the Earth is going to be 20,000 miles.
Okay.
Maybe 40,000 miles.
Okay. Yeah, let me look.
Let's say the radius of the Earth is 20,000 miles. So let's see. Pi r squared would get you the circumference of the Earth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So 20,000 squared would... be
400,000, right?
Yeah, 400,000 times pi. We'll just round pi to 3.
3, yep.
Gives you 1.2 million. And then it's going to go all the way. So you're going to go 1.2 million miles in 24 hours. So divide that.
Well, it's convenient. It's 1.2. So
1.2 divided by 24. Yeah, I mean, can I just use a calculator? 1200000 divided by 24
divided by 60.
50,000 miles an hour?
Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Wait, what'd you say? 50,000
miles an
50,
hour?
50,000. Yeah. Okay.
That was a good way to come to the answer. If you Google speed of the Earth, it says roughly 1,000 miles per hour. You can get into the exact numbers, but the problem started with your measurement of the Earth. So
yeah, well, right. I was wildly guessing. I
mean, wildly guessing.
What's the diameter or what's the radius of the Earth?
The radius is about 4,000 miles. So instead of 20.
Oh, and I did pi r squared, which is area, not circumference. Oh, I needed to do pi times pi. Diameter. Wait, what's the dumbass? What's the radius again?
It's about 4,000 miles.
Oh, so my first guess, I said 10,000 miles, didn't I? For diameter.
I don't remember.
Or 20,000 for diameter. So 8,000 for diameter. So 8,000 times 3, let's say roughly, 24,000 miles diameter. Oh, but then wait. No, 24,000 miles circumference.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it has to do that and every...
That's 24 hours. Oh. Yeah.
Whoa, so that's 1,000 miles an hour. Wait, but exactly. You said...
Yep.
Is that what you said? 1,000 miles an hour?
Yep. Roughly 1,000 miles an hour. Yeah.
All right. We're done. Wrap it up.
Hey, well, your background's getting lighter already, and that's why.
That's true. 1,000 miles an hour.
We got an email here from Kay. You got it?
Yep. Hi, Ben and Nathan. The summer before I started college, I took some community college courses to get some credits out of the way for cheaper. I knew my future college would take these classes as pass-fail and would not affect my college GPA. Long story short, my community college GPA was a 2.67, while my GPA from where I received my degree was a 3.89. Mm. Yikes. After the LSAT calculation, my GPA is a 3.78. Not bad by any means, but it is significantly lower. And that is bad for the top schools, by the way.
Yeah, I know it only looks like a tiny margin, but Dean Z talks about how UGPA is one of the main predictors of success in law school, and her median is 3.84. So the fact that your transcript shows a 3.89, Dean Z is never even going to see that, because she's instead going to see your LSAC GPA of 3.78, and that difference goes from above her median to below her median, and it changes her assessment of how successful you're likely to be in her law school. It also, she knows that she has to report that to the world. So it will hurt a school like that. It will hurt them in the rankings. So it is bad. That is bad news for you, Kay.
Yeah.
It sucks. It's fucking bullshit, really. Like that's so dumb, because how would Kay possibly have known that was going to happen?
No way. Yeah. She wouldn't even know what the LSAC calculator is.
Yeah. Her high school counselor is not like, I mean, her high school counselor was probably, if they're doing a good job, the high school counselor was like, you could go to community college and get some of these credits out of the way. You can get credits for cheaper.
And they're pass fail.
Yeah, they're doing you a favor, like by helping you get some credits out of the way in a low stress way, and you can just, tick off some boxes and save some money and make progress toward a degree, and they're helping you.
Yep.
Except for they were actually hurting you getting into the top law schools in the country, which just, God, that fucking sucks.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, Kay continues, I don't want 18-year-old me to hold myself back on a scholarship opportunity. My first LSAT score was a 165. I'm signed up to take April and June. I know with dedication I can get my test score up. But what do I do now about my GPA? Am I out of luck, or would schools look at just my higher institution GPA?
No, they won't.
Look, the best possible outcome here is that you get rid of that 2.67, and not only do you get rid of that, but you have a 3.89 at your undergrad institution, right? Are there any classes that we can get rid of there too, to bump the 3.89 up? That's the best possible outcome. So I don't know if that's possible. Can we talk to the community college?
That was beyond the obvious, which is get the very best LSAT you possibly can. She's already gone from 153 to 165. She signed up for April and June. that's awesome. You need the best LSAT. Everybody, no matter what happens with your GPA, you need the best LSAT you possibly can. You need to be above, you know, if we're talking about Michigan, you need to be above their median. If you're going to be a splitter, you know, their median is 171. You need to be above that if you can. And so keep grinding, get the very best LSAT you possibly can. And I'm sure you can do it.
Before we go on, I did want to say one thing. She says, I know with dedication, I can get my test score up. To me, that signals that she's not practice testing higher than her 165. So then I'm like, should you be taking it in April and June? Are you, what do you mean that with time you can get it up? I don't know if you're ready to take it again. That's all.
Kay should come to my study group, LSATdemon.com. Every other Thursday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, I do an open Q&A. You should come talk to me there. Oh, but wait, she's a live Demon subscriber. So ask me in class. I'm in class multiple times a week. Ask Ben in class. We need to talk about this. Are you really ready to take it in April or not? Mm-hmm. Don't just take it hoping to score higher. Make sure you're ready. Your practice tests aren't going to lie. If you're applying this fall, though, then you probably do kind of want to take it in April and June. Then the cycle resets. Then you can take it in August and September. Mm-hmm. So she's got lots of bites at the apple between now and this fall application. And she probably should be taking it if she's insisting on applying this fall. 165 is great, right? I mean, she's close. So she just needs, but she definitely, you got to buckle down on that. And you've got to not just know that you can with dedication.
Yeah.
Need to actually do it.
Yeah.
Are you perfect on the logic games? No? Why not?
Yeah.
But get perfect on the logic games. You need to be perfect on the logic games. That's just a matter of putting in the work. Have you put in the work? So do that. Let's talk though about this, because my first thought was call the community college.
Yeah. Can you get these classes removed? Can you retake them and then get credit for them now?
I would explain it to somebody. Find somebody sympathetic at the community college and go, hey, I'm an alumni of your school. When I went here, I got some credits done and I was very appreciative because I could get those credits done, pass, no pass, transferred to my ultimate bachelor's degree granting institution. And I did get a bachelor's there and I got a 3.9 there, 3.89 there. But here's my problem. I'm now applying to law school. Like, they want you to be successful. Okay. This community college is going to be proud of you that you're going to try to go on to law school. They should be. If you find the right person, they should be proud of you and sympathetic and want you to be successful. I mean, the case that I would make is, listen, I've got a 3.89 on my bachelor. It's on my transcript. I've got a 3.89. But because of this weird calculation that LSAC does, you see, this university counts these classes as pass, no pass, but LSAC weirdly goes back and looks at these grades. Can you change them to pass, no pass on my community college transcript?
Match them up, because then LSAC is going to just ignore them.
Right.
Exactly. Yep.
That, I think you have a chance there. Now, how much of a chance? I don't know. But you've got some chance if you make that case.
Well, getting on the phone too and talking with these people, I mean, I don't know. Can you retake classes and then have them change the grade, or at least LSAC would average them? Maybe. It kind of depends on the school policy, I think. I don't know what your options are, but.
So I would talk to the school. I would talk to LSAC as well. Like, get somebody on the phone at LSAC and explain the situation to them.
Yep.
Because who knows who you get at LSAC, and you might find somebody who's going to understand that this is really unjust. And there might be ways around it, because that was my second thing, is like, if you can't get the community college to change, maybe you could get LSAC to just count somehow just, oh yeah, we see what's going on here. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll just ignore that. Those grades are carried over into your degree to granting institution. We'll just consider them to be part of your whatever. I don't know, but I mean, it's certainly worth trying.
Absolutely.
That's what a lawyer would do for their client. Right. I mean, that's like, and we've just heard multiple reports recently of people getting weird shit changed just because they made some phone calls.
Yeah. Well, partly our problem, right, too, in the past was we were just like, okay, GPA is done. You can't do anything about it. You got to focus on your LSAT now. And that's not true.
Right. It's an example of just injustice in the world, injustice in the system, right? Mm-hmm. Like probably the highfalutin, high cost law school admissions consulting community has known this for forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't like make that public information because that's their secret special sauce. But it apparently is a thing that you can just call up and get special favors, which is not surprising because that's how the world works. And, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease and always has. So if you, I mean, and the worst that can happen is they say no.
Yep.
But Ben had another suggestion, which was what about retaking those classes at the community college? Now you'd have to get the community college to agree that they're going to change it on their transcript.
Yep.
Like, hey, if I come to your school and I retake this class, will you scrub that old grade and put this new grade?
Yep.
That's not as good as the first thing, which is just, hey, can you change these to pass, no pass?
Yep.
Because listen, I mean, it's not going to affect, and that can be part of your case, right? It's not going to affect my GPA on my college transcript. Like,
yep.
Look at my bachelor's. I have a 3.89. It's on my transcript for my bachelor's.
Yeah.
So making this change does not change my GPA on my transcript for my bachelor's.
Yeah.
All it's going to do is it's going to not fuck me for my law school admissions.
Yeah.
Kay, I hope you'll email us back. I really want to know if you're able to get this change through. I would call them. I would call LSAC. I would, you know, it could talk to LSAC and have them explain to you exactly what's going on, because it's possible even that the school that granted your bachelor's might have something to do about this. Like the way they represent it on their transcript might affect the way LSAC treats it.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe they didn't make it obvious enough or clear enough that these classes are already on your transcript. Therefore now LSAC is actually counting them twice.
Right. LSAC could totally be double counting them. So you could get LSAC to ignore that transcript. You could I think your best chance is to get the community college to change them to pass, no pass.
And that's kind of where I'd start, because I don't know. Then it's just like, it's a matter of course, right? You're like, okay, look, it's pass, no pass.
This is done. Re-upload the transcripts. LSAC redoes the calculation.
Yep.
You're done. But I would eventually, I mean, you might need to do a war of attrition here to just like, it might be a battle to try to get this done, but I wouldn't give up until you just have exhausted all possible. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the wishful thinking, would schools just look at my higher institution GPA? No, they will not. Now you can write an addendum, but that addendum doesn't do anything on their spreadsheet. It doesn't do anything on their index calculation. It doesn't do anything on the data that they have to report to the ABA. It doesn't do anything to their US News rankings. There's just no room on those scorecards for commentary.
Yeah.
So unfortunately for you, they're going to look at your LSAC GPA.
Yep.
And that's what we have to get that changed. This is worth tens of thousands of dollars to you, okay? So I would do it.
Maybe we need to stop saying UGPA and start saying LUGPA.
Yeah, it really is your L. Well, right. Because the admissions folk, they just, all they ever are going to care about, they're not going to give a shit. I mean, now, and of course they will say, oh, well, but you could write an addendum. Oh, definitely let us know. Because remember, what those schools want is for you to apply.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really interested in making you into a better applicant. They're just going to be like, oh, write an addendum. It's fine. But for you, you want to make yourself a better applicant so that they'll give you money.
Yeah.
And so the way you do that is you get that LSAT GPA. Yeah. LUGPA.
So, LUGPA. So from now on, we're focusing on our LSAT score, our official LSAT score, and our LUGPA.
LSAT,
the LSAC LUGPA. Calculated undergraduate GPA. Yep.
Thanks for listening to the LSAT Demon Daily Digest. You can email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.